I know you can manage it. This way, Penny. No, not through the shop. We will slip out the back door. Moments later, they were in an alleyway that connected to the back alleys and rear yards of all the shops and houses in Frankenford. Penelope followed her parents through countless twists and turns. They reached the edge of town without once setting foot on the street or in the square and without being seen by anyone. Beyond the village was the forest. There was no path in sight, only a silent, shadowy maze of tall trees blocking out the dim light of dawn. Her parents did not hesitate. What choice did she have but to follow? And so, like a character in an old fairy tale, Penelope marched bravely into the dark German woods. Unlike most young people in fairy tales, she had both her mother and father to guide her. Even so, her parents each made a shh gesture when she attempted to speak. The woods were quiet. Apparently, they needed to stay that way, but her mind was full of questions.
To say we are going to England is all very well, but how? It must involve being high up, since Mater Lumley asked if I was afraid of heights, Penelope mused. Curious. I wonder if we will scale a mountain with crampions and a pickaxe. Or perhaps the trip will involve a magic carpet, or, heaven forbid, a flying broomstick. Imagine trying to hold on to one of those at high speed. This train of thought may sound childish, but bear in mind that Penelope had muddled through without her parents for many a year. Now they were here and had taken charge, which left Penelope off duty, as they say. Frankly, it was a relief to be able to think like a child for once, and although she did not wholly believe in magic, who knew? Perhaps things worked differently here in Germany. Home of the Brothers Grimm and their peculiar tales about frog kings and golden geese, cottages made of candy and people no bigger than a thumb. Little girls in blood-red capes and, of course, any number of tricky and dangerous wolves. The Lumleys marched until they reached a lake. If it were winter, we would skate across, Mater Lumley remarked. Pater Lumley strode to a large rock outcropping not far from the bank. Hidden among the rocks was a small rowboat and a pair of oars, which he proceeded to drag to the lake's edge. Penelope hopped in with a sailor's ease. It was good to be on the water again. The wind was against them, but Pater Lumley was a strong rower. Within half an hour, they reached the opposite shore. This time they hid the boat in a hollow among the roots of an enormous tree. Thick green moss grew over the hollow like a stage curtain. One would never know the tree had such a hiding place within.
"You have done this many times," Penelope said to her mother.
"Countless times, yes. This is my favorite place in the world." Before them was a meadow as lush and green as a fairyland. The trees that circled it stood tall and straight like kindly protectors. There was a special quietness about the place, punctuated now and then by the high trill of birdsong. Mater and Pater Lumley walked with purpose into the meadow. Penelope scampered after them. "I wander through the meadows green," Mater Lumley recited softly as she walked.
"Made happy by the verdant scene," Penelope interrupted.
"Wanderlust, it is my favourite poem. Did you write it?"
Pater Lumley took his wife's hand.
"Yes, she did, and all the other poems in that volume too."
Mater Lumley turned to her.
"I gave that book to Charlotte for you, Penny. I called them melancholy poems because we were apart, but they are also full of the joy I always feel here in this meadow. It is the place that renews my hope. And now here I am, standing in the meadow green," Penelope's mind whirred.
"Wait, you said you left a clue for me. Was it in the Book of Poems? If so, I never found it."
"It was the tides of fate that brought you back to us, then,"
Pater Lumley said. Mater Lumley frowned.
"Where is the book now?"
"With the incorrigible children. I gave it to them when I was sent to Plinkst."
She looked relieved.
"That's all right, then. You will see them soon enough, and if they have solved it, I'm sure you'll hear all about it. Next time we are together, we will have a good chuckle over it."
"What do you mean, next time we are together?" Penelope asked, but her parents did not answer.
"Here we are,
Pater Lumley said, hands on hips. Both her parents turned their faces to the sky. There, like a strange giant flower blooming in the middle of the tender spring grass, was an enormous balloon. It floated serenely at treetop height and was tethered with ropes to a circle of stakes that had been hammered firmly into the earth. Beneath it hung a large basket woven out of reeds. It was not unlike the basket Margaret used to carry the clean laundry up and down the stairs at Ashton Place, except that it was big enough to hold a passenger or two.
"Is this yours?" Penelope asked, awestruck.
Pater Lumley shook his head.
"No, but we have a balloon of our own, even larger than this one. It is on its way, but is not here yet."
"If this is not your balloon, whose is it?"
"Well, it's mine, governess. Mine, all mine."
A man stood up in the basket. He was a tall fellow with white mutton-chop whiskers. He wore a pith helmet that had been painted to match the balloon's bright patchwork of colours and patterns, with a small, brave flag flying on top.
"Admiral Fawcett," she gasped. "What are you doing here?"
"Piloting a balloon, obviously," he bellowed.
Nimbly, he climbed down a rope ladder to the ground.
"The balloon business is booming, or ballooning, if you don't mind the pun. It's both profitable and full of daring do, which makes it an entirely suitable enterprise for a brave explorer like myself. I remember you, governess. You taught those three wolf children the Ashtons keep as pets. Excellent trackers, as I recall. We all went chasing after that big bird that got loose in the woods. What a marvellous pursuit that was."
"You mean Bertha, the ostrich. I remember it all too well."
Her tone was chilling, for Admiral Fawcett, he pronounced it for say, had made a poor impression on her the last time they had met. She turned to her parents.
"I do not know what dealings you have had with this man, but he is not to be trusted."
"There's no need to hold a grudge," the Admiral interjected. "I've learned my lesson. No more wooing rich widows for me. No more crackpot schemes about ostrich racing. I'll stick to good, honest ballooning from now on."
He stooped to retrieve a fancy-carved walking stick that was propped against one of the balloon's anchoring stakes. Clearly he did not need it for walking, but it proved useful for making grand gestures.
"So you know Hans and Susie too, eh?" he said, swirling the stick toward her parents. "I see a bit of a family resemblance, not that it's any of my business. Anyway, we balloonists tend to stick together. It takes courage and skill to brave the heavens, and good old Hans and Susie know as much about it as anyone."
Penelope flinched to hear her parents referred to so casually, but they did not seem to mind. Admiral Forsay slapped her father on the back.
"I keep telling Hans here to open an aerial show and sell tickets. Touch the clouds with the lighter-than-air Lumleys. Paint the landscape as seen from above. Why, they make a fortune. We prefer a more private existence than you do, Forsay," Pater Lumley answered. "The incognito Lumleys. That's you two to a T. It's a rare treat to find you at sea level, I must say."
Admiral Forsay turned to Penelope and jerked a thumb at her parents.
"These two could draw you a map of Alpine villages so remote the only way to get there is by balloon. Unless you're a goat, of course, and even those Swiss mountain goats don't go as high."
Penelope had always been a whiz at puzzles. Quickly, she put all the facts together.
"So that is where elsewhere is," she said to her parents. "It explains why all those paintings are painted from above. You live in the sky. And Edward Ashton has been searching for you on land all these years."
Admiral Forsay pounded his walking stick on the ground.
"Edward Ashton? The lying scoundrel. I'll not soon forgive him for the nasty trick he played on me. Any foe of his is a friend of mine, and I mean it."
He glanced at his pocket watch.
"Time's flying, and so must we. Now, which one of you is going to England?"
Penelope looked at her parents, her heart sinking. "The Admiral and his balloon will take you to England," Mater Lumley said gently. "We will follow, just as soon as we can."
But why can't we all go?"
Even as the words tumbled out, she knew how childish she sounded.
Not possible. Admiral Forsay rapped his stick on the side of the basket. My balloon's a compact model. It'll only hold two people of average size.
He hoisted his trousers around his ample middle.
I'm a bit larger than average, and you're a wee thing, so we'll be all right. I've got our provisions weighed to the ounce.
Peter Lumley handed him the carpet bag.
Here you go, sir. 7 pounds, 5 ounces, exactly. Sounds like a bouncing baby baggage. Ha ha!
The Admiral hoisted the bag in his hand for a moment before loading it inside.
Even a few pounds over capacity and we won't fly right, or at all, he explained. And we've a long way to go, over land and sea, hop, hop, hop.
Major Lumley spoke reassuringly. The Admiral is an experienced pilot, Penny. Do as he says, and you will be quite safe. Penelope forced herself to look up. The balloon was so small and the sky was so large, she would simply have to keep her eyes shut the whole time.
What's the matter, Governess? Afraid of heights?
That question again. Penelope squirmed. It was not so much that she was afraid of heights. It was that she was afraid she would be afraid of heights once at high altitude, and by then it would be too late.
Buck up, Penny, she scolded herself. You never minded looking out of the nursery window at Ashton Place, and that was on the third floor. Granted, there was an elm tree right outside, with spreading branches full of dancing leaves and friendly squirrels.
That cozy view never prompted the sick, panicky feeling of being unmoored from the earth that the phrase, touch the clouds, had stirred up in her.
I will go, she said with far more confidence than she felt.
Admiral Forsay scolded.
Better be sure, Governess. Balloon travel is not for the faint of heart. Once you're up, you're up. There's no changing your mind, for I can't very well put down in the middle of the English Channel. And the basket is small, so we've got to get along peacefully. No whining or complaining.
Penelope stood straight and tall.
Admiral, may I remind you, I am a Swanburne graduate. There will be no whining or complaining from me.
I should think not, Major Lumley said. Both her parents laughed at that, but it was the kind of laugh meant to keep things cheerful when sadness is right beneath the surface. Penelope knew the sound well. Admiral Forsay wet a finger in his mouth and held it up to check the wind.
Not bad, not bad. We'll be in England by week's end, give or take.
He climbed back up the rope ladder that dangled from the side of the basket.
All aboard! Governess, say your goodbyes. The sun has been up for an hour, and the wind is fair. Time to go.
Her parents each gave her a quick, tight hug. Peter Lumley offered a hand to steady her as she set foot on the rope ladder.
I am not afraid, she said, and climbed into the basket without help.
It was small, but not nearly as small as a herring barrel, and much sweeter smelling, too. The thought that she had already survived worse cheered her somewhat. Admiral Forsay added more coal to the small stove that heated the air and made the balloon rise. At once the balloon stretched taut, straining at the ropes.
Ready for takeoff, he called to the ground.
The Lumleys skillfully untethered the ropes, one by one. Major Lumley dropped the last rope. With a sideways lurch, the balloon began to rise. Penelope held on for dear life.
Goodbye,
she called, leaning over the basket's edge. Her parents were growing smaller by the minute.
We will see you soon, Penny dear, Major Lumley called, waving furiously. Soon, I promise. That is what you said last time, Penny yelled back, but her voice was swallowed by the wind.
The town of Frankenford looked even more picturesque than usual in the rosy glow of early morning. Some townspeople were already astir, for just as certain professions are the cause of late bedtimes, actors come to mind, and theatre critics too, alas, other jobs demand an early start. Bakers, for example. As Madame Ionesco herself could tell you, a baker must work in the dead of night in order to have plenty of fresh baked treats ready for the morning's customers. For who does not like a tasty apple strudel with their morning coffee? Or a thick slice of gingerbread, spicy and sweet,
still warm from the oven. Or even a scrumptious Berliner Pfannkuchen, filled with marmalade and dusted with powdered sugar.
Edward Ashton was a man obsessed, a man who had resolved to commit murder.
A man who had loosened the reins of his mind to gallop in pursuit of evil and was now unable to gather them up again. But he was also a man who had been travelling for days without rest or food.
He had arrived in the village an hour past dawn. He knew his prey was near, but the mesmerizing aroma from the bakery nearly made him faint.
"Breakfast, coffee, and then the Lumleys," he told himself. With a trembling hand, he opened the bakery door.
Ring, 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 ring. A ruddy-cheeked woman in a flour-dusted apron appeared behind the counter, protesting mildly that the shop was not yet open. She was still icing the Black Forest cakes. Could he come back in 10 Minuten, bitte? Ashton ignored her. He growled his order in German and paid for his coffee and Berliner Pfannkuchen. Think of it as an extra yummy jelly donut. He stood at the counter and shoved the food into his mouth like a starved animal, scattering crumbs over himself and the floor. The woman pressed her lips together. She grabbed a broom and swept all around him, right up to the edge of his shoes. But he did not move.
"Where is the bookstore?" he asked, waving the book of melancholy poetry around. "I know it is nearby. I have the address right here."
"Sometimes there is a bookstore in Frankenfurt, and sometimes there isn't," the woman answered, still sweeping.
"No riddles," he snapped. "Just tell me where it is."
"When there is a bookstore, it's next door," she answered curtly, and disappeared into the back. It was a perfect example of why one must always use good manners when making a purchase in a shop. The baker was hardly inclined to be helpful after that rude, wild-eyed fellow made such a mess in her bakery. And while she was in the middle of icing her Black Forest cakes, yet.
"Bookstore, next door. Bookstore, next door."
Edward Ashton left the bakery, muttering and flicking the ends of his black coat in annoyance, the way a cat would flick the tip of his tail when the mousey is just out of reach. He looked to the right, then to the left. On one side of the bakery was a shoemaker. On the other side was a shop that sold little troiline hats. There was no sign at all of a bookstore. He walked the length of the street and all four sides of the village square. No matter who he asked, the answer was the same. The bookstore was next door to the bakery. Sometimes. And sometimes it was not. His breath quickened with frustration and rage. What had he missed? Back to the bakery he went. He looked in the window and rested his forehead against the cool, smooth glass. Pastries, biscuits, the freshly iced cakes, each a work of art.
"Once I find the bookstore," he thought, "I will treat myself to a slice of that superb Black Forest cake."
Absently, he licked the marmalade off his fingertips. He would search the town again, 100 times, 100 times, 100 if need be. Perhaps a Tyrolean hatmaker could give him better directions. Indeed, he had always had a fondness for that style of hat. He resolved to go ask him, and, if the fellow was not in yet, to wait. On his way to the hat shop, he passed the bakery's other window. This one held a dazzling display of birthday cakes in many styles and flavors. Upon the largest of the cakes, the following words were written in a flowing cursive in English. "Happy birthday to our children, wherever you might be." The penmanship was quite good, considering it was all done in icing. Ashton sniffed doggishly. He frowned and sniffed again. He reached out to tap the window, only to find it was not glass at all, but an enormous canvas drop, a painted curtain, like the backdrop for a play. Fury rose within him as he tried to fight his way behind the canvas. It was not easy, as Peter Lumley had rigged an ingenious system of knots around the curtain's edge to keep it steady
in all weather. With a roar of frustration, Edward Ashton pulled a knife out of his boot and slit the canvas from top to bottom, coincidentally slicing the painted birthday cake in two.
Behind the gaping curtain lay the bookstore's actual window, with the Giddyap rainbow books on cheerful display. The store was dark, the door was locked. The sign read, "Gesloschen," closed. Pony books and birthday cakes. The Lumleys had been here all right, but they were already gone.
"I am too late," he said, and crumpled to the ground. If only those blasted pheasants had not held up his train. His mind raced. Horses, trains, boats, all were easy to intercept. He must think and act quickly. Like a man in leg irons, he staggered to his feet.
"They cannot get away from me again," he said, sheathing his knife. "Never, never, never."
By now, the square had filled with people. A few regarded the strange, muttering man with suspicion or pity. One or two may have noticed the ripped curtain, with the halves of the painted birthday cake now flapping in the breeze. But most ignored the strange scene and minded their own business. This is what busy grown-ups tend to do, especially in the morning when there are jobs to get to and errands to run. At such times, small children are the only ones who have time to notice things properly.
"Mama! Schau!"
Just such a child cried, pointing upward.
"Ein Luftballon!"
It was then that Edward Ashton looked up at the sky. The 13th chapter. A ship that flies in the air.
"Hang in there, governess. Take-off and landing are the bumpiest parts of the journey. Once we achieve altitude, we'll have smooth sailing. Never you fear."
Penelope made a small, miserable noise to acknowledge Admiral Forsay's remark. It was not the sickening sway of the rising balloon that had sent her to the floor of the basket with her knees clutched to her chest. No, it was watching her parents shrink to the size of squirrels, then toy soldiers, then mere specks that had made her curl up in misery, taking one deep, calming breath after another. Frankenford, as seen from above, could fit in a nutshell with room to spare, and the itty-bitty Lumleys could be no more than grains of sand within it.
"It is the coming and going that is hard," she thought, sniffling back her tears. "But better they should be the here and gone. See you later, Lumleys, then go back to being long lost. And think what it will be like for the incorrigibles, that is, my brothers and sisters, the three littlest Lumleys, to meet their parents once more." This happy thought got her feet under her. Soon she braved standing up. At first, she kept her eyes downcast and concentrated on getting her flying legs, so to speak. When she finally lifted her face, the rush of fresh air, and really, what air could be fresher? The canopy of sparkling blue sky all around, the sheer storybook magic of being in flight, washed all fear from her, and she spread her arms wide and laughed aloud. Admiral Forsay chuckled.
"I knew you'd come round. Enjoy the view while you can. Your parents, now don't deny it, I've got eyes to see with, miss, asked me to travel incognito as best I could. We'll have to sacrifice scenery for secrecy."
Penelope looked up. A brightly coloured balloon floating across a clear blue sky. What secrecy can there be in that? He added more coal to the stove, for the stronger the fire, the hotter the air, and the faster the balloon rose.
"You'll see. Lucky for us, it's springtime. April showers bring May flowers, as the proverb goes. There'll be no shortage of stratocumuli and nimbostrati to hide behind."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Clouds, governess. It's higher than I typically fly, but with enough hot air, there's no reason we can't get above the clouds." It's quite a sight. You'll want to put on your hat and coat, though. It does get chilly up there."
It was all as the Admiral described. When the balloon pierced the fog of the low-lying clouds, the air grew cold and damp. They were briefly blinded as the mist swirled all around, but soon they popped through to the other side. Above, the sky was bluer than the clearest day imaginable. Below, the tops of the clouds formed a thick layer that churned like an ocean of cake frosting. Penelope was tempted to reach out and catch some of her finger, just as she used to scrape the last bit of icing from the bowl when cook let her help in the kitchen. But she knew better, for clouds are made of water droplets and ice crystals, not sugar and butter and cream. And leaning out of a balloon in flight is never advisable.
Brrr.
The temperature had dropped 30 degrees already. Now she understood why her parents had packed her a warm coat and hat. Admiral Forsay made tea by heating water on the same stove that heated air for the balloon, and they each helped themselves to a sandwich. Occasionally, the Admiral glanced at a small compass he carried in his pocket, or added more fuel to the fire. Otherwise, he left the balloon to its own devices. Penelope cradled the warm tea between her hands.
"Admiral Forsay, I am curious. How do you keep this vessel on course?"
"On course? You mean, how do I steer the blasted thing?"
"Yes," he laughed merrily.
"You can't steer a balloon, Governess. That's the fun of it. It's just a big bag of hot air. It blows where the wind takes it. If you have a particular destination in mind, it's up to you to find the wind that's heading your way."
"You make it sound as if there are different winds to choose from," she said, not wholly convinced.
"That's because there are. The wind blows in all directions. Which one you catch depends on your altitude. It's much easier than steering when you get used to it. Just decide where you'd like to end up and choose the wind that suits you best. Now, hand me another one of those sandwiches, would you?"
Nothing passes the time like a good story, of course, and the Admiral was nothing if not a talker. Alas, all his tales tended to be about himself and his globe-trotting adventures, and there was a sameness to them that soon wearied Penelope. Eventually, she pretended to nap, so as not to have to listen to any more.
"Imagine what Miss Mortimer would say," she rued. "A Swanburn girl on a long journey without a single book to read." And only yesterday she had been in a bookstore too.
Grimm's fairy tales would have been suitable, given her recent experience in the German woods. The Arabian Nights and its flying carpets would also have served nicely. If only she had thought to borrow one of them. Luckily, the workings of one's own mind are highly portable, as they weigh nothing and take up no room in a suitcase. Penelope decided to occupy herself by making lists of questions for her parents.
"At 3 questions a day, in a week I ought to be able to ask quite a few. 21, to be exact," she thought. "The 7 times table is tricky, but the 3 times table is easy as falling off a..."
"Whoops! Scared you, did I?"
The Admiral chuckled as he lowered himself back into the basket. He had climbed up the rope rigging of the balloon to mend a small hole with a piece of rubber and some spirit gum.
"That was easy, just like patching a bicycle tire. Hans taught me how, but I've never done a repair on the fly before."
"Admiral Forsay, have you seen my parents' balloon?"
It had just occurred to her that the Admiral might have answers to some of the very questions she had in mind.
"I surely have. It's a magnificent vessel, much larger than this one. Looks a bit like a gondola. It's nicely camouflaged, too," he frowned. "I wonder why it was delayed. I hope nothing tragic happened."
At her stricken face, he changed his tone.
"Don't worry, no news is no news, as they say. I expect you'll see them soon enough, unless..."
"Unless..." But he caught himself.
"Unless nothing. Personally, I like to look on the bright side of things, and I recommend you do the same. One thing I've learned flying a balloon, Governess, when your spirits are lighter than air, it helps keep the ship afloat, if you catch my meaning."
On the 3rd day, they got caught in a thunderstorm. That was the most frightening part of the trip. No matter how hard Admiral Forsay maneuvered the balloon to rise above the storm, it remained stuck in the thick of it, bullied about by the winds.
"We've got to light it up!" he yelled.
All non-essentials were tossed overboard. They saved one sandwich each, but the rest went over. Penelope held on to the papier-mâché seashell as long as she could. She even considered tucking a note inside, like a letter in a bottle, in case she was never heard from again. But she had already tossed the carpet bag that held her pen and paper, and so the seashell went over, empty. Whether the carpet bag was mistaken for an albatross as it fell, we may never know. However, the papier-mâché seashell was carried by the wind quite a long way before landing, improbably but not impossibly, in the scorching sands of the Sahara. Decades later, it was found by scientists who marveled at the appearance of this perfectly preserved ocean mollusk in the middle of a desert. It was the cause of much scientific debate, until the small children of one of the scientists pointed out that the shell was made of shredded paper, water and flour, just like the stuff they played with at school. That sparked an entirely different debate about not poking around Daddy's office unsupervised, children being seen and not heard, and so on. Penelope and Admiral Forsay survived the storm, but the loss of the sandwiches was a great disappointment. Nevertheless, by minding their altitude and choosing their winds wisely, the two brave balloonists made their way across Europe. It was on the morning of the fifth day that the Admiral declared them safely across the North Sea. "How do you know?" she asked. The sky and clouds all looked the same to her.
"Go see for yourself."
Forsay was tall and could easily peer over the basket's rim. Penelope had to go right to the edge on tiptoes to get a good look. Far below, through the tattered clouds, the chalk cliffs of Dover glowed white as old bone, and the dark water of the English Channel was flecked with whitecaps.
"Home, sweet home. Now we just need to find Ashton Place," he said. "Do you think you'd recognize it from there?"
She tried to imagine a bird's-eye view of the estate. "It is surrounded by a large forest," she ventured.
"So's half of England. What else?"
"The house is extremely large and neoclassical in design," she added.
"So's Buckingham Palace," he retorted. "Think, governess."
She thought hard. What would be an unmistakable feature of the landscape that would be visible from high above?
"I know," she said. "There is a new train line that runs to Ashton Station, pulled by a Red Bloomer steam locomotive. If we locate the train from the air, it will lead us to the exact forest and large neoclassical house we are aiming for." He pulled on his mutton chop whiskers.
"A red locomotive, moving fast along shiny new tracks, and it blows a trail of smoke behind it. Like a man running after the omnibus while clutching a lit cigar?"
She nodded.
"That should be easy to spot. And you're sure the choo-choo's red?"
"As a rose," she said. Happiness swelled within her. Could they really be that close to home? The Admiral let some air out of the balloon to get them below the clouds. They followed the snaky line of the River Thames inland from the North Sea, passing directly over London. How incredible to see that marvellous city from above. The people were like so many ants at a picnic, swarming here and there in pursuit of crumbs. Was Simon down there somewhere? Was Madame Ionesco? Penelope could only wonder, for of course she had no way of knowing all that had happened while she was away. Farther inland they flew, over the tranquil patchwork of fields and farms that marks the English countryside to this very day, and, one hopes, for many years to come. The meadows were dotted with creamy white sheep.
"Like little clouds floating on the grass," Penelope mused.
She might never have thought this had she not spent time among the clouds herself, which is a perfect example of how travel broadens the mind. Ashton Place was only a day's journey by train to London. They must be getting close. Fearlessly, she leaned over the edge of the basket, searching the ground below.
"There it is!" she yelled.
There was no mistaking the curve of iron tracks slicing through the fertile earth. And there was the bloomer rolling along, a gleam of apple red trailing white smoke behind like the tail of a kite. She listened for the grating chug of the wheels and metal-on-metal screech of the brakes as the train rounded each curve, but it was still too far away. It did not matter. The train's silent serpentine progress gave them a line to follow. The Admiral proved deft at finding the wind he needed to keep the bloomer in view. Before long, a dense and mysterious forest spread beneath them. Then came the many colours of the garden beds, their bright spring bloom like a rainbow along the grand curb driveway Penelope knew so well and had feared she might never see again.
"I'll put down in a clearing in the woods if I can,"
the Admiral said, frantically letting air out of the balloon until they were skimming the treetops.
"This way, our arrival will be a real surprise. We'll come up with a careful plan of attack and take things step by step. Hop, hop, hop. Hey, Governess. Governess?"
He looked around the tiny basket.
"Blast! Where did the Governess go?"
The third-floor nursery at Ashton Place was open for business. Mrs. Penworthy had volunteered to act as the children's temporary governess, since they had no other and the baby nurse had time to spare for another day or so until the baby was born. Great heaps of knitting were folded and stacked all around. There were all the sweaters, mittens, hats and scarves one might expect, along with some more, well, unusual projects. For example, there was a knitted map of England that used blue yarn for the water, and a mix of greens and browns for the land, with the occasional white knot stitch thrown in to represent a sheep. This was Alexander's doing, as you might have guessed. Beowulf had knitted a carrying case with a strap, perfect for those times when one gets the urge to paint on plein air, and needs to carry one's portable easel, paints and brushes outdoors. As for Cassiopeia, she had knitted a collection of eye patches for playing at pirates, and a holster to fit a toy dagger that Beowulf had gnawed for her out of a fallen tree branch. He had painted it to give the impression of a gleaming metal blade, sharp enough to split an eyelash, but it was actually smooth sanded wood, and quite safe to play with. At the moment, Cassiopeia and her brothers were merrily swashbuckling around the nursery, slashing at imaginary foes. Mrs. Penworthy had declared the day's lesson to be making things up, pirate edition. This was enjoyable for the children and out of great practical use for Simon, for he had been struggling to write a play about pirates for some time now. Watching the children pretend was giving him ideas. The bards among you know that writing is 9/10 pretending on paper and 1/10 spelling and punctuation marks. The correct use of apostrophes is important, and choosing the right words is more important. But pretending will always be the most important part of the whole business, and who does not like to pretend?
"I like that slicing and dicing, Cassia Woof,"
Simon took notes with furrowed brow. "But if all the characters are made to walk the plank in the opening scene, the play will be too short. Can't we kill them closer to the end?" In reply came a muffled whoomp, thud. Then a creak, as of a bending tree branch, followed by an ouch. Simon stared at his pages and sighed.
"All right, walk the plank it is. But where do we go from there?"
"Simmerwoo,"
Beowulf said. Like his siblings, he wore a knitted eye patch. At the moment, he was staring at the nursery window, rubbing his free eye as if to get it to work better. But Simon was deep in concentration, his gleam of genius fully engaged.
"All right, let me think. All the pirates are thrown overboard. Who's left? Maybe, I know, it's improbable, but it just might work. Maybe the cabin boy can take over the ship and the plot."
"Simmerwoo!"
Alexander ripped off his eye patch and turned his spyglass to the nursery window.
"A cabin boy,
Simon frowned and tapped his pencil against his chin.
"Cabin boy, cabin boy. I could call it cabin boy on holiday. Say, that's not bad. Tap, 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 tap."
someone. Could it be that missing scamp, Nutswoo, was tapping on the glass of the nursery window?
Simmerwoo!
The children howled in unison. It was a strange, strangled howl, a mix of joy and confusion and disbelief. And it ended abruptly, as all three incorrigibles hurled themselves at the window and fought to be the first to open it. The spring breeze blew the curtains into the room like billowing sails, and the nursery filled with the scent of clouds and sky and apple, mustard and cheddar sandwiches. There was the faintest whiff of herring, too, for it would take more than one washing to get that smell out of a thick knitted sweater.
"Well," said Miss Penelope Lumley, who stood, wobbly but secure, on the spreading branch of the elm tree. Her hard landing made the branch sway to and fro, but she had sea legs enough to manage it, after all the travelling she had done.
"Isn't anyone going to say hello?"
The children stood frozen.
"Excuse me, Lummerwoo Bird, as seen from the nursery window," Alexander inquired in a shaky voice. "Are you real? Or pretend?" "We have been making things up," Beowulf explained, "so it's not easy to tell.
For example," Cassiopeia took out her dagger and recited in a foot-stomping iambic pentameter,
"Is this a dagger which I see before me?"
"Shakespeare," Penelope cried, full of joy, and clambered inside. She was correct, of course. The famous line about the dagger is from one of Shakespeare's tragedies. Alas, the play cannot be named within these pages. To do so is the worst kind of bad luck, for this particular play is thought to have a curse upon it. To learn more, you must ask your nearest thespian, but be sure to inquire about the Scottish play, and under no circumstances say the title, even if you do know what it is. To hear that accursed name would make any professional actor flee in terror, as if being chased by 1,000 theatre critics. Luckily, Penelope knew not to say the name of the Scottish play, as Simon Harley Dickinson, would she see him soon again too, had explained it all too long ago. "Your dagger is a pretend dagger, Cassiopeia, but it is a real pretend dagger, and very well made from the looks of it. And I, too, am as real can be. Oh, look at you all. It is so good to be home." Then she noticed Mrs. Penworthy. "Pardon me, ma'am. I am not a burglar, I assure you." The baby nurse had already leaped to his or her feet, but did not move toward the intruder.
"Hold on now," Simon said warily. "Is this a cabin boy I see before me?"
He could hardly trust his eyes either, as he had been making things up about cabin boys, and now one seemed to have flown right in the window with a squirrel aboard, no less. For the long-absent Nutswoo was there too, chattering and skittering joyously from one of Penelope's shoulders to the other. The dim-witted creature knew exactly who had dangled from a rope-ladder, hastily lowered from a balloon, and landed in the same spreading elm branches that the fluffy-tailed, beady-eyed menace called home. Penelope removed her knitted cap and shook out her shiny auburn hair, which matched the incorrigible children's hair as perfectly as one sock matches its mate.
"I am Miss Penelope Lumley," she said to the nurse. "I once was, and I hope will be again, the children's governess."
The incorrigible children threw themselves upon her. They barked and howled and yapped with joy. After all, they had promised Lord Frederick to practice being barky, and the incorrigibles always kept their promises.
"Why so wolfish?" Penelope said lovingly, as she hugged all three. "Clearly I have been away too long. But, madame, you surely do look familiar."
"That's Mrs. Penworthy," the children exclaimed, although they could hardly speak for laughing.
Simon grinned and pulled off his wig.
"Well, well, well," he said,
for even a bard can find himself at a loss for words when his heart is full.
"I can't imagine a better plot twist than this."
Penelope disentangled herself from the children's hugs and turned to her friend.
"Simon, I am overjoyed to see you and eager to know how you are. I am also curious about that costume you have on.
But first things first, have you located Madame Ionesco? Is she nearby? Does she know how to undo the curse?
Same to you, on all three counts, Simon scratched his head. As for your questions, I have, and she is. And yes, I think she might, but I don't know the details. She told me she wouldn't say a word about the curse until all four wolf babies had arrived. What's that about, I wonder?
But we are only three. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three.
The incorrigibles counted and spun in a circle until they got dizzy and fell down, giggling. Penelope looked at their dear little faces. What a surprise they had in store. There is a great deal to explain, she said. But it is a long and complicated story that is best saved until there is time to tell it properly. Four wolf babies, indeed. Well, never mind that. I have reason to think she will reveal herself now. To Simon, she added, Where can we find the good madame?
The bakehouse. She's been baking bread like mad.
To the bakehouse!
The children cried with enthusiasm, for surely there would be something good to eat once they arrived. This appealed to Penelope too, who was by now quite hungry. Yes, we must go at once. She looked down at her sailor outfit. I have no other clothes to wear, but perhaps it is just as well to travel incognito. If anyone asks, I am your cousin, Alf, a cabin boy on leave. Simon pulled his wig back on.
Alf it is, and I'll go back to being Mrs. Penworthy. Now, don't laugh. At the moment, I'm the baby nurse and substitute governess, and I intend to do a good job of it, too, until the real one is ready to return.
He waited until the children were busy putting Nutsuwu back outside, then quietly asked,
But what do you know about Edward Ashton? He's not here now, though Mrs. Clark told me he'd spent a few days as a house guest not 2 weeks ago. Looked like he'd been through the wars, she said, and seemed to have gone a bit unhinged.
He has been looking for my parents, she said. Have no fear. He can search the globe over, but he will not find them.
Your parents? Wait a minute. Is there more to this plot twist than meets the eye?
Cassiopeia ran back from the window and hurled herself atop Simon's shoulders.
Giddy up, Mrs. Penworthy, she yelled. Gallop to the bakehouse, on the double.
Mind the hare, Cassia Woof,
he admonished, for she had grabbed the two pigtails as reins and was yanking them this way and that. To Penelope, he said,
It's plain by the look on your face. The answer is yes. To be continued, Alf the cabin boy.
Yes, we shall save the rest for later, she said, eyes a twinkle. What a marvellous secret she had, and how much fun it would be to tell it. She took Beowulf by one hand and Alexander by the other. Despite everything that had already happened and all that was yet to come, at that moment she thought she had never been so happy in her life.
To the bakehouse!
As you recall, the soothsayer kept odd hours. She was not in the bakehouse, but Simon knew where she slept, in a little shed not far off. The path that led to it was flanked by a garden, now planted with strange herbs of the type a spellcasting soothsayer might need for professional purposes. Penelope was eager to hear Madame's solution to the Ashton-slash-curse problem, for indeed the curse had divided the Ashtons in two. "It ought not to be difficult for a weird woman of her skill," she said to Mrs. Penworthy as they walked. "We simply need a way to undo the curse, without committing," she stopped, not wishing to say, "murder" in front of the children.
"Rhymes with birder," she said instead, in a low voice. "Sheep herder,"
the children yelled, for they missed nothing. Children rarely do, especially when older people are trying to slip something past them.
"What a racket! What are you trying to do, wake the dead?"
It was the spooky madame herself, cackling merrily in the doorway to her shed.
"Murder is the word you're looking for, Cookie. We'll have none of that creepy talk around here. The dead hate that word for obvious reasons. Hey, wolf kids!"
"Madame Ionesco!"
The children were thrilled to see her at last and gave her many hugs.
"Thank you for the gypsy cakes," Alexander said, ever polite.
"You like the bread, huh? Me too. When the dough rises, it looks like a big balloon."
She gave Penelope a meaningful wink as she ushered them inside.
You just made it, Lumley. I was getting worried.
A Swanburn girl may arrive early or in the nick of time, but she is never late, Penelope said.
That's pithy, the madame said approvingly. Well, you're all here finally. Now we can talk. Sit down already.
There was nothing to sit upon in the shed but upended dough buckets, but they sufficed. Simon leaned forward, all eagerness.
Does that mean there's a way to undo the curse without committing...
He glanced at the children and dropped his voice.
Rhymes with a birder.
Blurred her?
Alexander offered.
Preferred her?
Beowulf suggested.
Maybe you misheard her?
Cassiopeia crowed.
Bloody murder!
The soothsayer yelled, impatient.
Yes, yes, I've got it all figured out, more or less. What do you think I've been doing back here?
Baking gypsy cakes?
Beowulf said, full of hope.
Besides that, I've been working on the curse.
She too found a bucket to sit upon. Luckily, Simon turned it over quickly before she fell in.
A curse is like a contract. Two parties sign on the dotted line. Neither one of them can change it. Unless...
Unless...
They all said at once. Madame Ionesco swung her legs until they kicked the bucket, so to speak.
Unless both parties agree to the change. It falls under Amendments and Modifications, page 642 in the Soothsayer's Almanac of Curses and Spells, 3rd edition. I had to do a lot of research, I hope you realize.
Thank you for your hard work, Penelope said, meaning it.
I'm just saying, don't be surprised at the bill. Anyway, if both parties agree, you draw up a new contract to replace the old. One signs, the other signs, and abracadabra! You're done.
Simon looked skeptical.
Hang on, madame. In this case, one of the parties involved was Admiral Percival Rancine Ashton. He's long dead, correct?
She rolled her eyes.
One of the deadest. You should hear him. What a bore. I wouldn't want to get stuck next to him at a party.
Penelope was thinking hard. And the other party was the sacred wolf on the island of Awuwu. Surely she's dead by now as well. The fortune teller shrugged.
Dead alive. It's hard to say. Those magic animals are kind of in between to start with.
Simon paced around the tiny shed, ducking his head occasionally because of the low ceiling.
So how do we get a long-dead admiral and a hard-to-say-if-she's-dead magic wolf to tear up an old contract and sign a new one?
Madame Ionesco cracked her knuckles as if preparing for a fight.
Dead is the least of our problems. It's the negotiation I'm worried about. We'll find out when the full moon comes.
That's tomorrow.
Simon turned to Penelope.
At least we won't have Edward Ashton to worry about.
Perhaps,
she said, for she knew how sharply fate can swerve between one day and the next.
We shall find out tomorrow.
Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow,
the children agreed. It was another line from that Scottish play whose title cannot be spoken. Perhaps some day Madame Ionesco could remove that curse as well. If so, she would surely go down in the history books as a hero to all in the theatrical firmament. However, as both Agatha Swanburn and her great-granddaughter were fond of saying, first things first. It was one of their pithiest sayings, and one of the wisest, too. Only one day left till the first full moon of May. Lady Constance seemed untroubled. She no longer took long walks in the garden. Instead, she passed the time in her private parlour with various companions, Mrs. Clark or Margaret or, of course, Mrs. Penworthy. But most often now it was Frederick who sat by her, pouring tea and rolling skeins of yarn as the mother-to-be knitted in slow motion by the window. Her constant prattle had given way to a dreamier state. Row by row, she knitted a baby's bib, but she would stop every few stitches and stare into the thin air, as if thinking thoughts too deep to be understood by anyone, most of all, herself.
Frederick,
she said during one such interval.
What is that object in the sky?
Do you mean the sun, dear? She answered calmly but firmly.
No, I do not mean the sun. The sun is not an object in the sky, like a kite or a ball tossed into the air. The sun is a burning source of light and heat, like a candle, only it is very large and very far away.
I imagine you are surprised, I know that, but I do, for I have been taking books from the library now and then, and reading them.
Is it a bird, then? Frederick guessed. Sparrow, perhaps. Nuthatch? Warbler?
I am not playing a game, Frederick. Honestly, come see for yourself.
Lord Frederick got up and parted the curtains.
Well, blast! It looks like a full moon to me. I could swear it's a day early. But what's it doing in the garden?
She stood up to get a better view.
Why, the moon is in the garden. How odd! It was in the sky a moment ago. It must have landed.
Frederick grew agitated.
Blasted almanac. I checked and double-checked. The full moon's not till tomorrow, so what's it doing here now? Yap, woof.
He tried to make himself yap and bark, but they came out as ordinary words.
All clear. There must be some sort of mix-up.
I should say so. But not only has the moon landed in my garden, it seems to be shrinking quite rapidly. Waning, is that what it's called? Yes, the moon is waning right before our very eyes.
She pursed her pretty bow lips.
It looks like a souffle that has begun to deflate. Oh, now I am desperately craving a souffle for lunch. I know we just had breakfast, but I am eating for two after all.
This is most disturbing. I'll have old Tim find out what's what.
Frederick ran the bell pull as he shouted.
Timothy! Timothy!
Penelope, the children, and Simon had arrived back at the house at the same time Lord Frederick was yanking on the bell pull. The enigmatic coachman nearly knocked them over as he dashed up the stairs.
Coming, sir. Out of my way, cubs. Ahoy, sailor. Pardon me, Penworthy.
That's Mrs. Penworthy to you, you old rogue. Allow me to introduce my cousin, Alf, a cabin boy on leave.
But old Timothy was already gone.
Wondering where old Tim's going in such a rush,
Simon remarked as they made their way to the third floor.
Some sort of horse emergency, perhaps. Anyway, Alf, I'm still trying to figure out the bit about four wolf babies. What did Madame Ionesco mean by that, do you suppose?
Penelope brushed the question off.
Why, I expect it is like The Three Musketeers by Mr. Alexandre Dumas. There are four musketeers in it, despite the title. Poetic license, perhaps.
I don't see the connection. And if I read my cabin boys right, he added slyly, you know something you're not saying.
Penelope blushed, for she had no wish to deceive Simon of all people. She let the children enter the nursery ahead of them so she could speak privately.
You are quite right, of course. I have news that is going to come as a great shock to the children. I want to make sure to tell them in just the right way, at just the right time.
Frankly, she had no idea how the incorrigibles would react. Would they be glad to have a big sister or disappointed to lose a governess? And what about Mater and Pater Lumley? Doubtless the children would be full of questions about their parents, very few of which Penelope could answer, as she had already had the chance to ask any questions herself. Meanwhile, Nutsawu was urgently tap-tap-tapping at the window. The children struggled to open it, but the top latch was stuck.
Nutsy, what's the matter? We don't see you for weeks, and now you're all demanding.
Simon strode to the window and got it open again. What he saw made him blurt a few words that were perfectly suitable for a sailor, but not often heard from a baby nurse, at least not while children were present.
What's the moon doing on the ground?
Alexander asked, quite reasonably.
Fall of Rome? Fall of moon?
Cassiopeia loved all the phrases of the moon, but the full moon was her favourite.
Moon balloon,
Beowulf declared, after a moment's careful observation. It could have been the start of a poem, but it was also an accurate description of what he saw. Penelope ran over to look.
That is no moon, she said, overjoyed. It is the long-lost Lumleys.
The 14th chapter. Moon plus moon equals two moons. What Penelope had told Simon in the nursery was true. On the one hand, she was eager to share the strange and happy truth of the Lumley family tree with the incorrigibles.